I'm your host, Gina Scott, and tonight we've got a great guest and a great topic, but we're going to go over a few of the usual things before we get started. As always, I would love to hear from the listening audience, and there's a couple ways that you can send me a question or comment. The first is that you can join the Facebook group, Gina Scott's Donner Shades. It's a closed group, that's just to prevent spam. You'll get approved usually within an hour if you want to join. It keeps you up to date on what's happening. You can see things posted by upcoming and previous guests as well. It's a fun little thing. Not a lot of stuff going on, but it does give you the important updates. For the questions during the show, that's not the best place. The best place to do that would be via email, and you can email me at giascott, all one word, at exogenynetwork.com. That's exogenynetwork.com. And I will check my email periodically throughout the show. So I will get that email and get your question in. You can also, if you would like, send me a question via Twitter. To send it via Twitter, just put at Gia Scott, all lowercase, one word, and it will pop up and I'll see it and I can pass the question on. You don't have to follow me or do anything else. Just put that at Gia Scott in there and I will see it. So with that said, I'm going to move on to introducing our guest. Our guest tonight is Christopher Carson from the Lunar Project. And Christopher, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Christopher Carson, and I want to go to the moon. How's that for an introductory line?
That's definitely an attention-getter.
And most people that you meet don't say anything like that. Of course, you know, I've met enough people who could introduce themselves by saying, for example, my name is Buzz Aldrin and I've been to the moon. It turns out that when you start talking about going into space, you start hanging around people who've already been there. But the thing that we haven't done so far, saying we, not just in the sense of United States or whatever, but we as humanity on a global scale, have not really done so far is gone someplace and stayed there. And you may ask, well, what's so important about this? And my answer is, well, it's cribbed from H.G. Wells, actually, who said long, long ago, probably 100 years ago now, we have two choices that lie before us, and one is the entire universe, and the other is nothing at all.
That's kind of a grim outlook, but, you know, with the expansion of our population, with the depletion of our resources, with the damage we've done to our environment, I can easily see where if we don't start expanding our horizons beyond our own planet, maybe we're going to be in trouble.
Well, I wouldn't call it grim, to be honest. I would say that it's one of the most marvelous prospects the human mind can imagine. Let me lead you down a little path here for a moment. Let me talk to you about the universe for just a moment. Now, in the observable universe, which is to say the universe which radio telescopes and optical instruments and so forth can see, which may not be all there is, but it's certainly all that we can see. In the observable universe, there are hundreds of billions. That's billions of the B, hundreds of billions of galaxies. And in our own galaxy, in our Milky Way galaxy, there are, again, hundreds of billions of stars. And in our own solar system, orbiting the sun, practically in our backyard, in our own neighborhood, as it were, there are, of course, the eight principal planets that everybody's familiar with, you know, from little bitty Jupiter up to great big Jupiter down to little bitty Mercury. One of these days I'll get that right. Probably not before I leave the Earth, though. Now, I'll still be making spoonerisms and malapropisms, you know, from the moon, and you'll just be tuning in to the radio broadcast from up there thinking, who is this guy, and how did he get up there? But in addition to those eight principal planets, we also have dozens of decent-sized satellites, including Titan, the big moon of Saturn, which is almost as big as Mars. And then there are thousands of minor planets. In fact, if you count the long period comets, millions of them, and then an almost incalculable number of smaller objects down until you get down to grains of dust so fine that they get blown out of the solar system into interstellar space by nothing more than light pressure. It's amazing all the stuff there is in the universe. And so to imagine that the only things that will ever matter to us are just the things which are on the surface of one planet in all that midst of all that vast majesty, well, to me, that's just madness. I mean, yes, this planet is a marvelous thing. It's a beautiful thing. But there are other marvels and other beauties out there. I don't see why we have to only have one set. And so to me, that is the perspective that I see, that it's not simply a case of, well, you know, we're running out of this, that, and the other thing. We have too much of so-and-so and such-and-such. To me, the most important thing here is that the universe itself is a magnificent place, and we're invited to play in that sandbox, as it were.
That makes sense. That definitely makes sense. And it does put it in a much more positive light. So why would the moon be an important part of this process of exploration?
Yeah. Well, the short form of the answer to that is because it's there, as the man said about Mount Everest. Now, that is only the very shortest form. To give you a better understanding of why I would want to go to the moon, I want to refer you to a book, which is NASA Study Publication 413, and the name of it is Space Settlements, a Design Study. It was published back in 1977, and it was the result of a conference that was held in 1975 at Stanford University. They brought together some graduate students and some engineers and let them play for 6 weeks, which I think is one of the best things you can ever do. But let me give you some background here. Now, this is a book that you can download from several different places on the Internet, from NASA itself or from the National Space Society's Space Library, for example, which is, by the way, linked from the Luna Project homepage, www.lunarcc.org. Anyway, what is the purpose of this book, Space Settlements, a Design Study? Well, let's go back to 1969, that glorious year when man first set foot upon the moon. Now, in 1969, there was a particle physicist by the name of Gerard O'Neill who had just arrived at Princeton University, where he was going to work on the particle accelerators there, which is what particle physicists do. But because Princeton is a little unusual for an Ivy League university, and it doesn't really have a lot of graduate programs, because he was supposed to be a professor, they set him to teaching an undergraduate class. And so since he had to teach an undergraduate class, he decided he was going to make it a seminar course, so he wouldn't have to do all kinds of tedious grading and things like that. And it was a special problems in physics course. And so he decided he was going to come up with a question every 2 weeks or so and let the class gnaw on it to see what they came up with. The very first question that he came up with was probably put into his head through the Apollo landings and so on, and it turned out to last him the rest of his life. And that question was, is a planetary surface the best place for a growing technological civilization? Now, that's kind of a challenging question, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they came up with an answer, and that answer turned out to be no. And there's you can break it down in several ways, but it comes to this. We're all living on the surface of a sphere, roughly a sphere. And on the surface of that sphere, we're pointed away from the sun about half the time. Most folks call that night. But the result of it is that we can't use solar energy very effectively. And all of the heavy metals, almost all of the heavy metals, iron, nickel, cobalt, uranium, copper, tungsten, almost all of that stuff, aside from a very, very small fraction, is down in the middle of the sphere where we can't get at it, not here on the surface. And, you know, there are other little inconveniences, like this marvelous oxygen atmosphere that we all breathe. If you ever have anything to do with making steel, you find out pretty quickly that that thing is a nuisance and a half. because anytime you heat up iron, it covers itself over with iron oxide. And then you have to go through some very complicated things to get rid of that. And aluminum is even worse. This is why welding aluminum is so difficult. Aluminum itself would be easy to weld, but it develops this thick coat of oxide as soon as it's exposed to the air. And tungsten, you know, and titanium will just catch fire if you take a welding torch to it. Considering how expensive titanium is and how expensive the things are that are usually made out of it, you can imagine why nobody would want to do that. So being on a sphere turns out to be kind of inconvenient. And so he said, well, what are our other alternatives? Well, if you could go out into space, just get away from the Earth two or three planetary diameters, then you're out in free space where you get the full strength of sunlight 100% of the time. And because there's no atmosphere to conduct heat away or to you, just by shielding something from the sun, you can let it chill down to very, very low temperatures. Or by using a solar mirror, you can heat something up to very, very high temperatures. And of course, high temperatures and low temperatures are both very important in all kinds of industrial processes, more important, in fact, than room temperature. And there are other things that are difficult even to quantify. But to give you an example, out there are these mountain-sized chunks of things like nickel iron floating around, that the metallic asteroids have a composition which is pretty close to what we think is the composition of the core of the Earth. But instead of being thousands of kilometers below our feet and at a temperature of thousands of degrees and at a pressure of tens of thousands of atmospheres that you couldn't possibly get to without cracking the planet in half, they're just floating out there where we could, you know, hack off a chunk. And so there was a great deal of inquiry into the question, well, now that we know that there are better situations for our civilization than the surface of this sphere, what do we do about that knowledge? And this study publication 413 is an attempt to answer that question, an attempt to take a hack at that question. And so they talked about building, for example, enormous settlements in space. Now, what you have to imagine here is like a cylinder made of steel, 2 or 3 kilometers in diameter, a mile or two in diameter, right? And spinning very slowly, a couple of revolutions per minute or less, so that on the interior of the sphere, the tube, the centrifugal force is similar to Earth gravity. And then on the inside of that, you've put an atmosphere, and you've got landscaping and all kinds of things. And people live there. And you can tailor the climate. So, for example, if you want something with the climate of San Diego, you can have it.
Uh-huh.
And, unlike San Diego, you can always build another one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, building another San Diego
is
a little tricky.
Yeah. I've got relatives who live out there, and man, oh man, the real estate prices. And now, if you could just say, okay, well, looks like we got too many people here, we could just need another San Diego and 10 miles down the lane, that would be a different thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it definitely would. So, you know, in the scope of this, the moon appears to be an excellent practice field, in a sense.
Yeah. Well, the key to the whole problem is that they were asking the question, where do we get the resources to build the first of these space settlements? Where do we get the resources to build the first orbital factories? Where do we get the resources to build the first solar power stations in space? So on like that. And they said, well, the best place we know to get these materials is the moon. But the way they went about it, they said, well, what we're going to have to do is scoop up dirt, basically, off the surface of the moon and use a thing called a mass driver, which is nothing more or less than a kind of electromagnetic sled, to shoot that dirt right off the moon. Because, of course, since it has low gravity and no atmosphere, you don't have to use rockets. You can actually simply throw things, if you throw them hard enough, much harder than even the best baseball pitcher, but throw them hard enough, you can get them to go into orbit. Okay, so we're going to take those things and we're going to throw them off the moon, just bags of dirt, and going to catch them and process them in an orbital factory. But the way they figured it They were going to have to take that mass driver, which is a big piece of engineering, piece by piece, and move it to the moon. It's going to have to be built on Earth, taken apart in sections, put into rockets, launched on rockets, taken to the moon, and reassembled there. And then they were going to have all the factories which were going to process that material, built on Earth, taken apart into sections, launched into space, reassembled in space. And so you have to have hundreds of guys on the moon and hundreds of guys in orbit to do the reassembling work. And you've got to provide them with food, water, and air and all this. And you've got hundreds of thousands of tons of material that have to move off the Earth before you can ever process your first pound of lunar material.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine that's a big economic problem. If it costs $1,000 a pound to get something off the surface of the Earth, you don't want to lift hundreds of thousands of tons.
No.
And that is a big part of the reason why nothing was ever done about this. You know, there was an organization formed, the L5 Society, to promote O'Neill's ideas. Actually, it merged into what's now known as the National Space Society in the 1980s. I'm actually a director of the National Space Society right now.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a free plug for them. Anybody who wants to know more can go to www.nss.org and find out all about them. But the National Space Society advocates for this kind of thing, but the question is always still, how are you going to get somebody to pay for that first step? And so what I ask myself several years ago now is, isn't there a better way to do this? Isn't there a way to do this where we would not have to lift hundreds of thousands of tons from the Earth? Because that's the impractical part. If you can get those numbers down, then the cost goes down. And instead of looking at a $1 trillion project, which would be, you know, something on the scale of a major war, which would obviously have to be funded by national governments, and if you've paid any attention to national governments lately, you realize they couldn't find their way out of a wet paper sack, much less, you know, to undertake a project like this. I said, is it possible? Is there even the remotest possibility that this can be brought down in scale to the extent that it can be done by the people who want it done? And the answer I came up with was yes. And the way to do it is actually pretty simple when you think about it. See, it's now been over 50 years since the first human being went into orbit. Yuri Gagarin, you know, April 12, 1961.
Uh-huh.
So that's coming up, you know, in a couple of days, Saturday actually, coming up Saturday, it'll be 53 years. Okay. So in the course of all that time, we've learned relatively little about working in weightlessness. I hate to say that, but it's true. There have been some very interesting experiments, but most of them have been on a small scale. Talking about producing hundreds of thousands of tons of metal, refining it from lunar ores and like that, we don't really know much. We can't do it. But if you go to the moon, the gravity there is lighter than it is on Earth. But things behave in roughly the same way. In other words, if you have stones and water, the stones will sink to the bottom and the water rises to the top. And if you put in bubbles, the bubbles will rise to the top and burst. And that's really important, as it turns out, because many of the processes that we use industrially depend on exactly that kind of phenomena. And not only that, you know what else depends on exactly that kind of phenomena?
The human body?
Toilets. If you ever tried to use what passes for a toilet on the space shuttle or the International Space Station, you would think, these guys must be really serious to put up with this for weeks or even months at a time.
Uh-huh.
It's really, really awful. Whereas, on the moon, a toilet works pretty much like a toilet, and it looks pretty much like a toilet, and you use it pretty much like a toilet. There's no suction and no whirling blades. I'm not making this up.
Uh-huh.
Just a regular toilet. Yeah, suction fittings and whirling blades. Particularly those of us of the masculine persuasion are probably have got our, you know, shoulders tingling right about now. That's very fun.
But, well, whirling blades and suction involving the toilet isn't exactly appealing, I don't think, to anyone. Probably not even to the astronauts that have used that type of a toilet.
No, no. Most of them would be much happier if there were something better. And, of course, if we had these big spinning space habitats, then, of course, we could provide those. But there's always been a problem. You know, back in the 1950s, everybody was talking about we were going to build these big wheel-type space stations. And the wheel would spin, and inside it, there would be centrifugal force, which would take the place of weight. And, you know, if you saw the movie 2001, for example, there's one of those in there. They were a staple of science fiction in that period.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with them turns out just to be that there was something that nobody predicted before the first satellite was launched. And that's what's called the Van Allen belts. And the Van Allen belts are really inconvenient. See, the atmosphere extends fairly high, and these Van Allen belts are belts of trapped radiation around the Earth, which extend fairly low, and there's not much of a gap between them. And so if you want to be below the Van Allen belts, then you're always brushing the top of the atmosphere, which means that you're always slowing down and getting to the point where you may fall into the ocean. Ocean, if you're lucky. Now, the problem here is, why would you want to be below the Van Allen belt? Well, the answer is, if you have to launch everything from the Earth, then every ounce of weight matters. And so, since the only good way to protect against the radiation of the Van Allen belt is with mass, turns out that hydrogen is the most efficient, but you could use polyethylene plastic, or you could use water, or you could use aluminum metal, or anything really. This is not one of those cases where lead is your best choice, because it's particle radiation. If it hits lead, it'll actually produce X-rays, whereas if it hits hydrogen, it just slows down and heats up. But the trouble is, if you wanted to build a space station high enough that it wouldn't constantly be in danger of spiraling down towards the Earth, you'd need it to be very massive. And again, we get into this problem of thousands and thousands of tons.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got those thousands and thousands of tons from the moon, then you could build scientific research stations in orbit, which would stay up for long periods of time, which would allow you to have both weightless labs and habitat areas which have weight. And so the key to the whole solar system really is going to the surface of the moon with industrial pilot plants. Now, these don't have to be very large. Just little plants where you can take the lunar soil and, for example, if you put it into a closed chamber, the tort, and you heat it up, you get gas coming off. And part of that gas is hydrogen, and part of it is helium, and part of it is other things, nitrogen, argon, and so on. And one of the things that happens there is that those gases all have some industrial or biological use. And then you take that soil, which you've driven the gas off of, and you can melt it, run an electric current through it. I know it sounds crazy, but you can. You get oxygen, of course, comes off, because the lunar soil is basically made of the same minerals as the Earth's soil. In other words, oxygen, silicon dioxide, right? Iron oxide, magnesium dioxide, titanium dioxide, and so on. All of those very common minerals. And so when you put it past an electric current through it, it splits up those ionic compounds. Oxygen comes off. And then you get iron and aluminum and silicon and magnesium and titanium and all those other good things at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that you can produce oxygen. And, of course, I mentioned you've got hydrogen already. Oxygen and hydrogen together make water. You've got metals, which you can manufacture into things. Most people aren't aware, but actually just plain stone can be used for a lot of things. The dark areas that you see on the surface of the moon, in other words, you go out, you look at the full moon, which we're going to have on the 15th, and it's going to be a lunar eclipse visible from North America. You look at the full moon, and there are these dark patches. Those patches are actually composed mostly of a rock called basalt. It's a volcanic rock. If you went up to Arizona, you'd be hip deep in it. In Eastern Europe, cast basalt and basalt fiber are big industries.
Okay, I've never heard of basalt fiber.
Yeah, there's actually a company down in Houston which has licensed the technology. It was developed by the Soviet Union. Heaven knows why, other than that they were always interested in whatever new technology they could come up with. But it turns out you can take basalt and melt it and spin it into fibers and make cloth out of those fibers. Now, it's not the kind of cloth you'd want to wear necessarily, but astronaut coveralls. If you've ever looked at an astronaut, you know, wearing those blue coveralls, those are made of what's called beta cloth. Beta cloth is glass fiber cloth, but the fibers are coated with Teflon because otherwise they saw against each other and break. It turns out that basalt doesn't have that problem nearly as bad, so you don't have to coat the fibers in plastic. So, on the moon, where plastic is going to be a fairly scarce commodity, because, of course, it requires carbon and hydrogen and those things that you'd really rather like to use in your greenhouse, then you're going to be able to use things like basalt cloth, things like cast basalt, and also glass. There's actually two kinds of glass that you can get out of the lunar soil itself. There's volcanic glass, and there's what's called impact melt glass, where a little meteorite will hit the surface and actually cause the grains of rock on the surface to melt and form glass. And there's lots of other opportunities. For example, back in the 1920s, Professor Neuninger, who was the first person to make a systematic study of meteorites, invented something called the magnetic rake. And what this is a kind of a magnetized deal that you tow behind a car, and it picks up any little bits of magnetic material. And what he was using it for was going out in the Midwest, for example, and picking up little bitty meteorites out of the soil. Now, if you think about that for a minute, you realize, if you think about that for a minute, you realize you could tow something very similar behind a lunar rover, and you'd pick up little bits of magnetic material. Now, you take those back to your campsite, and you subject them to an induction furnace. Now, here on Earth, we'd call it a vacuum induction furnace, because you have to pump all the air out so the metal won't catch fire. But on the moon, you don't have to do that. There's plenty of vacuum already, high-quality vacuum. You can melt that down, and part of it is meteorite debris, and part of it is other local minerals that are magnetic. And it melts down, and because, again, you've got enough gravity for this to happen, the metal sinks to the bottom, and the silicate material, the rock-type material, floats to the top. And then you can tap off that metal and use it to make things. And that nickel-iron alloy that meteorites are made out of is actually the basis for all of our super alloys. In other words, things like Hastelloy and Inconel, the stuff which is used, for example, in jet turbine blades.
So it sounds like, you know, once you set up that initial very small colony on the moon, it would become more than self-sustaining.
That's the idea, yes. The idea is that the moon is the key to the solar system because it provides us not just with something to look at in the night sky that's pretty, although you'd be surprised how important it is. After all, we can see that it's another planet like our own. That's very powerful. I mean, you ask somebody to point out Mars in the night sky, most people wouldn't even know where to look, much less how to find it.
I had it suggested to me in the past also. The moon sort of acts as a target to catch a lot of the meteorite material that could potentially be much more hazardous to the planet as well. And it affects our tides. It does a lot of things for the planet besides just be something pretty in the sky.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't deny that. But from a human perspective, you know, most people, well, the moon has a great deal of influence on us, which we don't understand and find hard to quantify. I mean, there's always the story of the Palolo worm of the South Pacific that lives at the bottom of the ocean, but always spawns in regard to the phases of the moon. How does it know what phase the moon is? But so it's always possible there are influences that we have find hard to identify.
Well, listening to you talking about the moon as a source of very useful raw materials to begin the process of colonizing our own solar system and then reaching out further, that sounds great and wonderful. But having seen some of the ecological disasters on this own planet as a result of natural resource exploitation, what's to prevent one of these corporations or whatnot that have done those types of things on this planet from going up there and turning it into a hollow Swiss cheese orbiting nothing and, you know, then affecting the planet's survival by that exploitation of the moon?
Well, there are a couple of answers I could give to that. And the first one is kind of the trivial answer, which is that it's hard to cause an ecological disaster where there's nothing living, and the moon is so large. I want to point this out. People think of it as small. It's small by planetary standards, only about 1/85th of the mass of the Earth, but that's still large by anybody else's standards. If you were to mine it for 100 million years and take off 1 billion tons a year, you might change its mass by 1%. So the magnitude of the effort it would take to really ruin the moon would be almost inconceivable by human standards.
So hopefully we'd wise up before we turn it into a wiffle ball.
Probably so. The second part is a little more challenging, but I suppose I could say it expresses my hopes and objectives if I can say that living in space is the kind of thing which is going to require a great deal of, for want of a better term, mindfulness. When you're in an environment where you can't just dump your waste into the nearest stream, right? The Earth's ecosystem is so large and so forgiving that over the years we have grown accustomed to assuming that it'll clean up after our mistakes. And that's really misleading. Out in space, you're up closer to it because you've got two problems. The first problem is you can't discharge waste products into your living space. You'll die. And the second part is, you can't dump them outside because you need them back. Many of the worst wastes that we have industrially are things like polychlorinated biphenyls. Polychlorinated biphenyls used to be used in electronics because they have wonderful properties, but they're also horribly poisonous and very, very hard to get rid of. And so, factory sloppiness and poor disposal practices, they wound up in the groundwater, and there are places where you dig wells and this stuff comes up. It's awful. Polychlorinated biphenyls, they're hydrocarbon compounds with chlorine hanging off of them. Well, out in space, hydrocarbons, chlorine, these are things that you need in order to live. And so instead of just dumping them everywhere, you would have to recapture them and break them down chemically and turn them into something useful because you couldn't afford not to. And so there's a kind of a mindset, I think, that develops when you're in that kind of situation where you're responsible for yourself. It's kind of like Mother Earth has been cleaning up our room. When we move out, we're going to have to clean up our own room.
Okay, that makes sense.
And hopefully, you know, my great hope is that that development of the perspective and the mindfulness that you have to have when you're responsible for yourself that way will help us to come back and solve many of the problems here on Earth. Because the truth is, now, you can read The High Frontier by Jerry O'Neill, or you can read The Third Industrial Revolution by G. Harry Stein, or Colonies in Space by Tom Heppenheimer, and these are all excellent books. But they all sort of assume that once we start doing asteroid mining, and once we start building power satellites, once we can furnish electricity, raw materials, advanced manufactured goods to the Earth without having to do any of those dirty industrial things on the surface of the Earth, then all our ecological problems will be solved. I'm not sure. I think we also need that mindset that comes with being responsible for yourself, and also the practical experience of what happens in an ecosystem. Because you think about it, a space colony is a self-contained ecosystem. It's got more mechanical parts than the Earth's ecosystem has. You've got air pumps and that kind of thing. But fundamentally, you have to manage all those things that the Earth has been doing for you. And so you get practical experience as well as the mindset that comes with it. And so I believe, or at least I hope, I very strongly hope, that that experience of being responsible for ourselves will enable us to come back to the Earth and stop doing all those stupid things we've been doing and do smart things instead. And the shorthand way that I like to express this, anytime somebody says to me, but don't we have all these problems on Earth that need solving first, is I like to say, I think many of the problems we have on Earth, in order to solve them, we need a perspective that's broader, that a global perspective is too narrow.
Okay. All right. Because I have heard, especially from people that were adults before the beginning of the space race and whatnot in the early 60s, they really don't see space travel as a wise investment. They see it as a foolish science experiment, sort of gone mad, you know. They really think that the money needs to be invested in healthcare and solving problems, you know, right here, right now. So you wonder, you know, which is really important? You know, are both important? Is space travel really this luxury we can't afford?
Now, the answer that I would give to that, I'm sure you've heard of eating your seed corn. And fundamentally, that's what we're doing on Earth right now. Every day that we're digging up coal out of the ground and burning it, and sucking up oil out of the ground and burning it, drawing off gas out of the ground and burning it, all those are really valuable things, and we're just setting them on fire. And that's kind of a metaphor for our whole state of civilization today, that we've achieved great things, but we need to achieve much greater things. Frankly, there's billions of people in the world who have no access to clean water. And the only way that you can provide clean water for billions of people is with lots and lots and lots of energy. And it's also going to take various kinds of raw materials, maybe platinum and palladium as catalysts. And all of that we have, it comes from space. Every form of energy that we have here on Earth, except for nuclear energy and geothermal, are all forms of stored sunlight. You know, we've got biomass. Well, that's obviously plants growing in recent years. Coal, plants that grew millions and millions of years ago. Oil probably actually came from the oceans, the algae in the oceans, again, many, many millions of years ago. And so this is stored solar energy, which we're just using up real fast. Platinum, again, very important industrial catalyst, used in all kinds of industrial applications. Almost every platinum mine on Earth is an old meteor crater. Driefontein in South Africa is the classic one. It's an old meteor crater, 80 kilometers across. You can hardly imagine the size of the object that must have struck the Earth to make a hole that big. But
we certainly don't want to see it in modern times.
No. No, indeed we don't. And I put it to you that if we're going out there and herding around some of the little rocks so that we can scrape off a bit here and there and use them, then we'll also be able to increase our chances of not having one of those things hit us.
Well, I know, like in Canada, I forget the name of it offhand, there's a nickel mine. There again, it's an impact crater.
Yeah, Sudbury. Sudbury Astrobleem. I'm actually planning on visiting that this summer. I've been in Canada a couple times in recent years, and in fact, even in Toronto, which is in Ontario, and never managed to make it out to Sudbury, but I'm going to do that this year, I think. One of the things they have up there is the big nickel, that actually the nickel for Canadian coinage at least always used to come from Sudbury, and so they built a great big nickel about 12 feet in diameter.
Uh-huh. Well, that's got to be more impressive than seeing a big Paul Bunyan and his blue ox.
So, you know, that's exactly right. You know, that metal, in fact, one of the ores that they mine there is the craziest thing you've ever heard of, Sudburyite. Well, maybe not the craziest thing you've ever heard of, but I thought it was pretty crazy. It consists of little balls of nickel iron alloy, like BBs, which are just dispersed in the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, the thing that hit there hit so hard and so fast that it came apart and the metal simply tunneled its way through the rock until it came to a rest.
I don't recall the diameter of that impact, and I know it's a very, very old one, because it wasn't until fairly recent times that it was even identified as an impact site. But the nickel there is supposed to be, you know, very high grade, and it was all, you might say, alien in origin.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, this is material that comes down from the sky. Matter of fact, it's generally believed that the first iron used by humans, the first blacksmithing anybody ever did, was with meteoritic iron. That was how we got our start with iron.
Okay. It kind of makes sense because, you know, iron ore on the planet itself, it doesn't occur in a form that, you know, the average person is going to recognize as iron.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, that copper ore, of course, copper sometimes occurs as metal, as gold does and silver does also. But copper ore melts, you know, it smelts at a low temperature. And so if you had a cooking fire and you threw a piece of this rock into it, the rock might actually melt and give you copper at the end of it. It might poison you, too, because it's typically sulfide ore, and cooking sulfide ore, you get sulfur dioxide, which is deadly poisonous. But the next person to come along to your campsite would find copper in the ashes of the fire and might draw the right conclusion. Iron requires far higher temperatures, and it requires tricks. Here on Earth, the only way you get iron is by smelting with carbon. What you do typically is you mix up a bunch of iron ore with a bunch of coal and also a bunch of limestone, and you drop it into the top of an enormous chimney, which has got an air blast coming up from the bottom. And the coal catches fire and produces carbon monoxide. And the carbon monoxide strips the oxygen off of the iron oxide. And the carbon mingles with the iron to make iron carbide, which has a lower melting point than iron itself. And then that rains to the bottom of the chimney. And the limestone captures some of the other material, makes slag that floats on top of it, and stops the air blast from burning it up again. Now, in space, we don't have to do all that crazy stuff. We've got masses of metallic iron the size of mountains just floating out there. The Department of Energy did a study back in the 1970s which said that if you could just snag one of those asteroids, a small one, that you could actually meet the entire U.S. steel industry demand for steel, for crude iron, for 200 or 300 years. I want you to consider that a moment.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, in fact, if you think about that, you realize that one of those asteroids like that would have a value just for iron, not for the nickel, which is more expensive, or for the platinum, which is always found in meteorites, but just for the iron alone, would have a value comparable to the entire gross domestic product of every country in the world added together for the whole 20th century.
Now, here's a question. You know, with this sudden vast glut of high-quality raw iron for industrial use, wouldn't that cause the price of iron to drop to a level where it would no longer be profitable for anybody to be mining iron on this world or elsewhere?
Well, honestly, what happens is that your whole concept of how economics works just breaks. When it starts raining soup, you can't charge people for it anymore. But on the other hand, you think about it, iron is fundamental to the way that we do civilization, right?
Right.
If you can get iron in enormous quantities practically for free, then everybody can have his own empire state building. I mean, that's a crazy way of putting it. But
you know, logic says you still have to pay for the technology to turn it into things that are useful to you. Obviously, you give me a iron rod, and also I need a big, heavy stick to beat something with. It does me no good.
Mm-hmm. But there's a, and there have been interesting books written about this, but all of our economic theory is based on scarcity. In other words, it's based on the assumption that there's not enough stuff to meet everybody's needs. There's not enough food. Everybody could always eat more. Well, you know, that's not true. There's a point at which you just can't choke down another hamburger. But economic theory is based on that idea. And matter of fact, that's a big part of what advertising does, is to try to create artificial scarcity by making you want more of something than you otherwise would have, or by making you want something that you never would have wanted before.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start having asteroid mining, orbital factories, solar power satellites, scarcity stops to a great extent. A lot of things, they're just not scarce anymore. And so the whole economic system, which you've worked up over centuries, all of which depends on there not being enough for it to go around, stops working completely. There are people who talk about the singularity. They say, well, you know, computers are going to get faster and faster until they're going to start doing things we don't understand. I don't know about you, but I think a lot of people have that experience already.
Yeah, I had a blue screen of death earlier. I have no idea why, because it wasn't running hardly anything, and it shouldn't have done that. So was it something I understood? No.
Yeah. But people talk about a singularity as being this thing where the world changes into and becomes something that you could not have seen coming. I'm not sure exactly if that's what's going to happen, but there's been a lot of talk about what happens when scarcity stops being the dominant factor in economic life. And so, for example, Peter Diamandis, the founder of the XPRIZES, among other things, wrote a book on exactly that topic. Let's see. I believe it's just called Abundance. But that's part of the future that we're looking towards.
I hate to interrupt you when you're on a roll here. But, okay, when you're looking at this concept of scarcity that drives our current economic system suddenly becoming irrelevant, people with money, industrialists and bankers and people who predict our economy and all the people are revolving around it, they must find that particularly threatening, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a big
So you're not able to get much support for this entire project from that type of person, it sounds like.
Well, that's probably true to a great extent. It's not completely true, but it's probably true to a great extent. But frankly, if you wanted to get lots of support this day and age, you want to go out and look at Wall Street. It's very difficult to get money for any kind of big project that takes any amount of time at all. They want to lend money for 3 months, maybe, if they like you real well. It's not like it was in the 19th century. You know, most of the great railroads in this country were financed on 100-year bonds. Matter of fact, I've got a certificate from a railroad bond that was for 475 years. Can you imagine borrowing money at 4% interest for 475 years?
No.
Yeah. It's just completely alien to us today, even though that was how the railroads in this country were financed. That was how the big investments that made this country the industrial powerhouse that it became in the 19th century, the global dominant power that it still is today, that was how those things were financed. And if you want to look and see why we aren't doing so well now, you need look no further than the fact that it's hard to get money for anything for longer than a year. And so I always figured from the very beginning that it would not be the capital markets any more than it would be the governments. Now, I'm sure you're going to ask the question, right? Natural question. Well, if you don't go to the capital markets and you don't go to the governments, where do you go?
Right.
And the short answer is to the people. specifically to the people who care, I have a little rule. And it's a very simple rule. It goes like this. You never get anywhere by expecting people who don't care about your issue to do something about it.
Well, that's true. So how... I know that we're getting close to the break, so you're not going to be able...
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at this project. This is a big project. It's probably beyond the scope of one person to know all the science, all the technology that is required to it, you know, even as an overseer. It's beyond any one person's scope. So how are you going to manage to make this project, you know, say, assuming that some angel descends from somewhere and has all the money you need, how would you make it get off the ground?
Well, the very first thing that has to happen is, I mean, I try to provide leadership. And that means that if someone has a question, I try to be able to come up with an answer in the knowledge that somebody else will be able to come up with a better one. And so if someone were to descend on me with, say, $1 billion, which I could use any way I wanted, well, the first thing I would do is something I've already planned to do, which is go to the International Space Development Conference, which is being held in Los Angeles in May. I'm going there anyway. It's held by the National Space Society. Annual board meeting is there. I'm a member of the board. I'm going to be there anyway. And I know some people there. I start talking to people. I find the people, you know, the Gwynne Shotwell, head of SpaceX, you know, who's Elon Musk's, the person Elon Musk hired to run SpaceX. Elon may be there. There are going to be a bunch of people there. I start handing out retainer checks. And I start networking. I've already started networking, actually, years ago. That's why I go to things like this. That's how I became an NSS director.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if, like I say, if somebody were to descend on me with $1 billion or so, which I could use to jumpstart this, I already know the people that you need to talk to. I know who to go to for the landing stages. I know who to go to for space capsules. I know who to go to for guidance. I know who to go to for life support systems. I know who to go to for space suits. I know these people. I've spent the past 7 years cultivating relationships with these people. And so many of them think I'm a little bit of a nut, but we all think that about each other, and we think it about ourselves. I mean, I cheerfully admit it. I'm a lunatic. I'm so much of a lunatic. I'm going
Chris,
to the moon.
On the lunatic note and going to the moon, we do need to stop for a break. Folks, if you have questions or comments, once again, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com or send them to me via Twitter with @gscott. And outside of that, don't go anywhere. And we will be back in just a few minutes with more about Colonizing the Moon with Christopher Carson. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Christopher Carson about Lunar Project and colonizing the moon. Before we get
Thank
back
you,
on that conversation, though, I'm going to stick in a little plug here. If you're a cook, if you go camping, you like to read, whatever, you can check out the books that I've written at bit.ly/GiaBooks, GiaBooks, all lowercase, and you can see what's available. So the camping season's coming up, and there's a couple of camp cookbooks, as well as a book about taking kids camping. So with that, we're going to go right back to our conversation. Christopher, before we went on break, we were talking about, you know, if you had an angel come along and hand you $1 billion to get your project jump started. So what would be the very first thing that you would have to arrange to get your project up and running?
Well, to tell you the truth, there are a lot of things that sort of have to be done at once. But the long lead items, that is to say, the things that require a lot of lead time, the biggest ones, believe it or not, are rocket launches. These days, if you want a rocket launch, you have to schedule it years in advance. Now, with SpaceX, for example, coming into the market, those times are getting shorter, but still, 18 to 24 months is about as fast as you can possibly get a launch, and a lot of people have waited a lot longer than that. Matter of fact, at the moment, there's nothing going to be launched out of the Eastern Test Range, which is to say Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, Cape Kennedy, because the Air Force had a fire in one of their radars. Now, this gives you an idea of how bad things are with respect to space in this country today, that, firstly, space traffic control, as it were, in other words, responsibility for launches, is being handled out of a military organization, not out of something like the FAA. And secondly, when they've got an equipment failure, it takes them weeks and weeks to get a replacement. Now, you think about that for a minute. If you were flying out of LAX, for example, and they have a radar go down, they bring another one up within an hour or so, because you can't just have planes not land and take off or all get diverted to San Diego and Burbank. No, this is important. But our establishment currently does not see space as important, and I think we've touched on some of the reasons for that. You know, firstly, it does things that are too far out in the distance for them to understand, and secondly, it does things that in many cases they probably don't even want.
But it also doesn't offer any photo ops for politicians.
Oh, man. I think the last person to try that, I think, was, what, did John Kerry put on a bunny suit and go to inspect a space shuttle or something? Something like that, and was not well received. I have always said from the very beginning that the Luna project was intended, designed from the beginning, as being the plan that didn't require any miracles. Now, you can go out there and you can listen to Robert Zubrin, who wants to go straight on to Mars. And his plans generally require some kind of a miracle. You know, John F. Kennedy rising from the grave to lead us all onward into the celestial future, or something like that. Charismatic politicians capable of actually getting Congress to do something. Other people, their plans depend on all the investment bankers on Wall Street waking up in the morning with an itch to do something smart. Again, miracles.
Especially since there seems to be a rash of investment bankers committing suicide lately.
Yes, suicide. Funny enough, many of them scheduled to testify in major trials. Suicide, falling out of high windows and so on. Now, I'm not here to promulgate any conspiracy theories, but it's entirely possible that the pressure got to them and they committed suicide, and it's entirely possible that something else got to them. And either way, it's pretty clear that the kind of decision-making which is going on in high finance circles right now is not the kind of decision-making which is going to get us into space.
No, no. At least not the kind of space that we're talking about.
Right. And so, from the very beginning, I've said that the key to really doing anything is to get the people who care behind you, because the people who don't care aren't going to do it. And the power of numbers is what works here. You know, corporations have lots of money to play with because they have lots of investors. They've got thousands and thousands of people putting money into shares or into bonds, and that's how they get together the millions of dollars that they have to work with. The government, you know, in the U.S., we've got 350 million people, more or less, many of whom pay taxes. And so the government, you know, takes a scrape off of everybody and piles that all up in a big heap, and that's how you get the government having enough resources to do big things. But 350 million people in the U.S., about a billion people in the whole industrialized world. Now, suppose just for a moment that 1% of those people are interested in space enough to do something about it. 1%. Now, doing it on a strictly money basis, and I have something else to say about that in a minute, but just on a strictly money basis. So 1% of a billion people is 10 million people. If the cost of the whole lunar colonization project is $10 billion, and that's within the ballpark that I've been able to estimate, all right, $10 billion, that's $1,000 per person out of 10 million people. And that's over the course of a decade or so. A lot of people could come up with $1,000 over the course of 10 years. That's not even the thing that you're committed to. That's something that you're supporting, you know, semi-casually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easier for some people than for others. But, and that doesn't account for the fact that, frankly, a lot of what's needed can be done other ways. Yes, rocket launches have to be bought. Okay, there's no way around that, other than attempting to home build the things. And considering the learning curve, I really feel that buying them is the way to go. But a lot of other things, scientific research, a lot of really good scientific research over the years has been done by people working in their garages. A lot of stuff is done on a hobby basis. You know, Americans work at their jobs, and then they come home and they work a lot harder at their hobbies a lot of the time, because that's what they care about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, from that point of view, what I would call community participation is very, very powerful. But to give you a simple numerical example, I mean, and I'll just say this. Suppose that we wanted just to do minor things, right? Advertising campaigns to raise consciousness, this kind of thing. That could be done by paying money for it, right? Or it could be done by people volunteering their time and effort. Artists, for example, animators, people who edit video, people who edit sound. You know, and so the question is, if somebody ordinarily works for $100 an hour and is willing to put $10 or $15 of his hours into a project, then that's the equivalent of, you know, $1,000, $1,500.
Right.
Which is, often it's much easier to get somebody who's interested in something to work for a few hours to make it happen than to contribute that amount of money. On the flip side, you know, even people who are not doing too great will find that a dollar here or there isn't that much. And so if it were to happen that everybody out there in the audio listening radience were to go to www.lunarcc.org and they were going to go to the sort of upper left-hand corner where it says purchase merchandise or donate money, and they click on donate money and go down and give me a dollar. Well, of course, PayPal would take their cut and the IRS would take their cut, but even after that, I would have quite a bit of money to work with, which I could use to hire animators. Maybe they'd be willing to work for less, but it's sometimes easier if you can pay somebody something, because artists have to eat, to do other things like that, to buy television time. You know, you can buy television time in really small blocks now through Google Ads.
Oh, well.
Yeah. If you want to produce your own TV commercial, it turns out apparently that late night reruns of the Glenn Beck Show, you can get a 30-second ad spot for like $10. Of course, you know, things that are a little more popular go up, obviously, in price. But there's so many TV channels out there now. You can actually buy TV advertising pretty cheap. And, man, the kinds of commercials I've seen on TV recently, it shows. but, so, you know, as I said, and it's not just me saying, well, I need money to do the things that I do. Because I do. I mean, I'm not ashamed of saying that. But that's a way of participating that people who honestly are way too busy, they're way too stressed, they don't have time to think about what they could do and how they could do it. That's something that's really easy. Like I say, a dollar, that's not much. In fact, $10 isn't much to most people. And at $10, and this is something I'm just going to tell everybody, if you send $10 to that donate link and include your address, I will send you a tube, mailing tube. And what's more, it'll have 10 Luna Project posters in it, beautiful color posters that I had printed. So, you know, the tube by itself is pretty spiffy, but the posters are really what sells it in my mind. and the reason I'm not just mailing them out to everybody in the world is just that postage stamps cost money. A big part of what I try to do is getting people interested, getting people involved, spreading the word and raising awareness. And raising awareness involves printing costs and postage costs and web hosting costs and web advertising costs. And as I say, I'd love it for it to include TV and radio advertising costs too. But I haven't got to that point yet. And of course, it also involves conference registrations and transportation and so forth. Because if I'm going to a conference to spread the word, I got to get there somehow, and I got to eat along the way, and I got to sleep indoors. You know, it turns out it doesn't work real well if you attend a professional conference and you've been sleeping out on the lawn of the hotel. They tend to frown on that kind of behavior.
Yeah, and it's kind of tough to look professional if you've been sleeping in your car too.
Yeah, that's the absolute truth. And of course, I wrecked my car on the way to the last space shuttle launch.
Ah, not a good thing.
Yeah. That was a real disappointment. I mean, not the launch, but the wrecking the car. I actually made it, but I left the car, went to watch the launch, came back, and the car was sitting in a green puddle. I had, it was a little Mazda sedan, and what had happened was I was driving from my home in Texas to Titusville, Florida, and the last two or three miles of the trip, minivan in front of me made a sudden stop. I tried to follow, the anti-lock brakes didn't work quite as advertised, and I fetched up with a flak against the rear bumper of the minivan, which didn't even have a paint mark or a scratch on it. My car looked okay.
Looked okay. Looks deceiving, huh?
Yeah, it turns out the bumper of the minivan, it hit the grill, knocked the grill into the air conditioning condenser into the radiator, and the radiator into the fan. $3,500 worth of damage on a car with a book value of $3,000.
Ah, yeah.
I wound up selling it to a scrap dealer and flying home. And not a scratch on it, but it was totaled.
Uh-huh.
That was a great
that's
disappointment.
That's disappointing, yeah.
But, so, you know, that sort of... I was never very fond of long road trips, and that really sealed the deal. These days I try to avoid driving farther than I really have to because I don't want that to happen again. But completely
beyond my own
personal comfort.
I've walked thousands of miles on road trips, and I've never had an accident. Knock on wood, find some wood.
Yeah. Well, like I say, it was kind of a freak thing, and it wasn't helped by, you know, the fact that I'd been driving semi-continuously for many, many hours. But... you know, it was just sort of a great disappointment to me. But completely apart from my own personal sob stories, yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is something in this world completely apart from my own personal sob stories. You know, just a little example of everybody pitching in a buck or $10 or something, not only would that allow me to do more of what I'm already doing, it would also allow me to do things that I'm not doing. And this is the crucial part, because this is not all about me. I give that impression sometimes, maybe, but this is not all about me. It would help me to bring in people who up to now have been on the periphery or have been limited in what they could do. Like I say, I know artists who would love to produce art to be used in Luna Project publications and promotional materials, but they've got other projects which are paying them money, and those have to go ahead of the Luna Project work, simply because they've got to eat and make rent. And so if I can give them half of their usual rates, then they're not 100% volunteering anymore, and that means they're a little further towards eating and making rent, and the Luna Project stuff can move up in the queue. It's the same way with a lot of things. That it turns out that having at least a little money greases the wheels to an enormous extent. And so, again, at the risk of sounding mercenary, and God knows, mercenary is certainly something I know how to sound, you know, if everybody out there, everybody listening, would want to go to the Luna Project homepage and go to that little link that says donate money and send me a few dollars, my gratitude would be enormous. And there's also a thing that says purchase merchandise. Now, you may ask, what do you mean merchandise? Well, most of those are things that I said, it's not just about bringing in income, it's about spreading the word. Like I say, if you send me $10, I'll send you posters, which you can put up all over the town, and people say, wow, Luna Project, what's that? I sell on eBay. One of the things I sell is bumper stickers. You buy a bumper sticker, you're not going to stick it in the bottom of a bedroom drawer, are you? You know, and with your socks? No, you're going to put it on your car. And as you drive around town, people are going to look at it and say, Luna Project, what's that? And maybe some of them are going to go home, and they're going to look up the web page, and they're going to say, huh, wow. Now, I'm talking about money a lot here, just these last few minutes. I don't want to give the impression all I care about is money. On the other hand, it'd be a lie to say that I don't care about money. I'm a coin collector. I care about money the way that you might care about your pets. I know that sounds strange, but if you haven't figured out already that I'm a strange guy, you haven't been listening very long.
Well, you know, you think about this project, though, because I originally heard about it watching a documentary on Netflix, of all places.
Yeah, Lunarcy.
Yeah, so
yeah,
you see this stuff, and because I was like, well, that sounds really interesting. And, you know, so yeah, I connected with you. We talked a little bit, and I was like, you know, I want you to come on the radio show. And, you know, there again, it's a case of you present a very good case for why a lunar colony would be something important enough to invest time and effort into achieving. But, you know, there again, we're not seeing much in terms of NASA's space projects right now because the American government isn't placing much importance on it for whatever reason. I mean, you know, I've heard everything from conspiracy theories to simply voters' apathy. But, you know, it boils down to NASA doesn't have much money. They were supposed to have already made a mission to Mars, and I don't know how many times that's been postponed.
Yeah, that was the good old 1984 mission to Mars. We were going to send a man to Mars in 1984 so he could watch the Earth pass across the face of the sun.
Well, obviously that didn't happen.
Very long while.
You know, I saw the NASA Mars team at Meteor Crater in Arizona. It must be about 10 years ago now. And they still haven't gone to Mars. And we haven't gone back to the moon. And, you know, the International Space Station is history. You know, I don't know really what's going on with our space project in general. You know, I'm kind of out of the loop on that. I haven't really checked on that much. But the deal is that not much is happening. You know, as a kid growing up in the 60s, moon launches or you know, Apollo launches were a big deal. Everybody was glued to their TV through the whole mission. Now, you know, like when the Columbia exploded, well, I happened to be watching that day, which was unusual because I usually didn't watch. You know, most of us don't pay that much attention. None at all.
Yeah. I mean, to an extent, well, there are those who would argue that's a good thing because it means that people begin to accept it as normal. In other words, space is, you know, space activity is no longer something that say, oh, it couldn't be done. Well, people are doing it. The thing is, okay, you can look at it from the following perspective, right? Nobody in the world has an Australia program. If you want to go to Australia, you go down to the airport and you put your $1,500 on the table and you buy a ticket. It's not something where you have to, you know, go into training for 5 years and commission a specially built sailing vessel and all this kind of thing. No, you just go down to the airport and you buy a ticket and you go to Australia. On the other hand, we're in this weird place with space now where on the one hand, yeah, people don't go crazy over every launch. On the other hand, we've got a lot fewer launches than we should have. People aren't going into space in any great number. In fact, we just passed the 500th person to go into space.
Okay.
So we're in this weird kind of place where the shock of the new has worn off, but it hasn't actually become a routine normal thing. You know, when Space Shuttle was first conceived, it was advertised as being doing exactly that. They'd have 5 shuttles, and they'd fly each one about every 6 weeks, and you'd get about 50 launches a year. 50 launches a year, and just, it'd be like airline operations. Well, of course, that didn't happen. Nothing even vaguely resembling that happened. Space Shuttle managed about 125 launches, 130 launches, over 30 years. An average of about 4 launches a year, which is pathetic. I'm not going to mince words here. You know, I'm not somebody who feels the need to apologize for NASA. NASA is a U.S. government institution. And the problem with U.S. government institutions is that a U.S. government institution can only do what Congress and the President tell it to do. You know, Congress has got to provide money, and the President has got to provide direction. And neither Congress nor the President are people to whom space issues are in the forefront. Now, I'll say this. You know, if one of the major political parties were to collapse and just not be there for the next election, could we run people on a space party ticket? Well, maybe. But the amount of energy you need to win a major political campaign is so large these days that you might as well just go into space instead. To give you an idea, the amount of money that was spent in President Obama's first election campaign by him and, of course, by the other side, if you total all that money up, it would be considerably more than what I would need to start putting people on the moon. And so, from my point of view, why bother? Why bother getting into politics at all when it just soaks up your money, it soaks up your effort, and it takes years to see results? Whereas if you put that same money and that same effort into buying launches and building spacecraft, you could be on the moon. I could be on the moon. I could be on the moon in the time it would take to get through the next election cycle.
So, you know, okay, thinking about I tend to be a person that I like, you know, nice practical visuals. When you think about that first colony on the moon, what kind of living quarters and environment would they be living and working in?
Okay. I can actually give you a very specific description because that's something I've been working on for a while. You know, what does it look like? How do you do it? And so that's, I can actually give you, let me set the stage for you, all right?
All right.
So this is something that costs between $500 million and $1 billion. I was hoping to get it in under $500 million because that amount of money was actually on the table as a single individual private pledge for a series of unmanned lunar science missions about 12 years ago. Unfortunately, for reasons having nothing to do with technical feasibility, those missions didn't fly. But $500 million. Looks like it would actually cost maybe 3/4. And, you know, you always want to put in some margin for error. But, okay. So, what do we have? The first thing that happens is, as a ride-along payload on a communications satellite launch, we have a little probe, right? Communications satellite goes into what's called geosynchronous transfer orbit, which is an orbit with a high apogee. In other words, it goes up to a high altitude, and then at that altitude, the communications satellite fires a little rocket engine, puts itself into circular orbit. That's a 24-hour orbit that circles the Earth. Now, that high altitude orbit is actually very close to the orbit you'd have to be in to get to the moon. And several probes over the past few years have actually launched as ride-along payloads in the extra payload capacity of a CompSat. So, What's this little probe do? Well, it may be, in fact, one of the Google Lunar XPRIZE teams that comes up with this. You know, that Google has offered a prize of millions of dollars for a team which can land a probe on the moon. So, if they're already working on that, we don't have to make our own. We just piggyback on them. What does this probe do? This probe lands on the surface of the moon, specifically in a place called Plato Crater, which is at about 10 degrees west longitude and 50 degrees north latitude on the northern shore of the Mare Imbrium, the Sea of Rains. It's actually a very easily distinguishable feature on the lunar surface if you've got a pair of binoculars. doesn't require much. It can't be seen with the naked eye, but only barely. Now, it takes photographs as it's coming down, which give us a very, very accurate idea of the topography in the region where it lands. And it's got a little radio transmitter on it. The radio transmitter serves as a beacon. So, the next thing that happens is we have ordered several Falcon Heavy rockets from SpaceX. Now, the Falcon Heavy has a payload capacity to low Earth orbit of 53 tons and an advertised price, if you are willing to buy three or more, of $80 million. To give you some perspective on this, the next best option, the Delta IV Heavy, is 20 tons to Earth orbit and more like $400 million. So five times the price and 40% of the payload. So, what do we get this Falcon Heavy for? Well, we've got a thing. Now, Boeing, I have to give you some more background here. Boeing is building all-electric communication satellites now. In other words, they don't have a little rocket that fires to put them into circular orbit. Instead, they've got electric ion drive. They've got big solar panels, and they just take that electricity and use it to power an ion drive, which slowly pushes them into the right orbit. Now, what we do is we take that same principle and we build it larger. In fact, we build it 50 tons, okay, 50 tons. So we put that into a medium Earth orbit. In other words, it's a circular orbit which is above the worst of the Van Allen belts instead of below it. And then turn on that ion drive, and this satellite moves itself into what's called an L1 halo orbit. Now, the L1 point is halfway, well, no, it's not halfway, but it's on a line between the Earth and the Moon, and it's a zone of stability. You put something there, and it roughly stays there. And a halo orbit sort of circulates around that point. Now, what's the point of putting a satellite there? And this great big satellite, I mentioned it's got lots and lots and lots of solar panels, generates a lot of electricity. That electricity is then turned into a laser beam, which is fired through a telescope to a spot on the surface of the Moon near where our little lander went. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're going to ask, why are you doing this? Well, I'm going to get to that in a minute. So then we have another Falcon Heavy that launches. And this one has got two little spacecraft stacked on top of it. Well, actually, they're not little. They're pretty big. Each one is based on the Centaur rocket, which is the upper stage used with the Atlas V launch vehicle. Centaur has been used since the 1960s. It has an excellent safety record, works almost all the time, and this is interesting, it's also very high performance. A Centaur is basically a stainless steel balloon full of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen with a rocket engine underneath it. It's very lightweight and very high performance. So, that Centaur, the Centaur stage, there are two of them, each with payloads on top. And those are lifted out of the atmosphere by the Falcon. They separate. And then each one fires into an orbit that takes it to the Moon and then fires again to land on the Moon. And it's able to do that because of the radio beacon, which allows for accurate control. Now, each one of those landing stages is basically a can. And the can is 5 meters in diameter, or about 16 feet, and about 4 meters long, which is about 13 feet long. Okay. Just a cylinder, airtight cylinder, which has got various things shoved inside it. Actually, on that first launch, one of those is actually what I call a contingency payload, which isn't in a can. It's packaged differently, so you can get at it easily without having to dismount anything. That's going to be important in a minute here. So, we then wait a little while longer to get everything set up again, and we launch a third Falcon, the second launch with the Centaur stages. And this has got two payloads. One of those payloads is another can full of stuff. The other one, the one that goes on top, has got a Gemini capsule on top of it. Now you may say, well, wasn't that a space program of the 1960s? And the answer is yes, but there's some nice folks in Huntsville, Alabama, who've been building a modernized one. And the Gemini capsule is very small and lightweight. Now, it's not very comfortable. There were some folks back in the 60s who spent weeks in Gemini capsules, and it's like spending 2 weeks in the front seat of a Volkswagen. Not the most pleasant experience you've ever imagined. But for 3 days that it takes to get from the Earth to the Moon, it's not that bad. And believe it or not, back in the 1960s, there was a lot of work on using Gemini for Moon missions. Because it was so small and lightweight, you could do silly things with it. And so, we've got this Centaur stage with a Gemini capsule on top, but the Centaur can actually land close to 15 tons on the moon. And the Gemini is maybe 2 tons. What do we do with the rest of it? Well, essentially, and this goes back to something called the MOL program for Manned Orbiting Laboratory, which was an Air Force program of the 60s. Essentially, between the Gemini capsule and the rocket stage, there's an adapter. And that adapter is a conical-shaped thing, right? It reduces the large diameter down to a small diameter. That adapter is fitted out as a travel trailer. Not kidding, travel trailer. You get to the moon, and you open up a hatch in the heat shield of the Gemini, in the base of it. Now, that doesn't sound very safe, but they actually tested it, and it works fine. And then you climb down into that travel trailer. Now, the thing is, the travel trailer has got your toilet and your cook stove and your camp beds and everything else and your spacesuits folded up in it and so on. It's a little thing you can live in for several weeks. And it's very convenient because, remember, we're not in weightlessness. So the stuff in the travel trailer doesn't have to work in weightlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just ordinary stuff. You can have hammocks, for example. You don't have to Velcro yourself to the wall the way they do in the space station if they want to get any sleep. So you got a travel trailer. That's nice. It's not good enough, obviously, to be going on with, but it'll get you started. So you've got these other payloads. You've got two of these payloads which have landed, which are in cans, and you've got the third, which is the accessible payload. So you get out there, and you start unmounting the stuff from the accessible payload, and the very first thing is a crane. You've got a crane, you've got a rover, you've got a bunch of other stuff. Spare spacesuits, extra food, water, and oxygen in case things don't work out well for you. All kinds of other things are in that accessible payload. And then you dismount the two payloads that are in cans, and you empty out the cans, and then you bolt them together end to end. And suddenly you've got an air-sealed space, which is 5 meters in diameter and 8 meters long, which is a long sight larger than the average double-wide mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
So, then what do you do? Well, here's the trick. On the moon, you're exposed to several hazards. One of them is cosmic radiation. If there's a solar flare, the protons coming from the sun can actually cook you like a hot dog. It's not pretty. And then you have the hazard that if you try to shield yourself from those, you can stop those protons. The shielding will just slow down the galactic cosmic rays, which will cause all your hair to fall out. That's not good either. So what you've got to do is bury yourself. And that instead, well, of course you don't bury yourself, you bury your habitat, right? Your living space. You put a big layer of dirt on top of it, and that protects you against the cosmic rays, solar radiation, against meteorites, and against the extremes of heat and cold. Because the lunar soil, the regolith, is actually an excellent insulator. It's like styrofoam. Only mineral. So kind of abrasive. But all that to one side, notwithstanding. The question is, where do you get the power? You're going to have to dig a great big trench in the ground and then lower your habitat into it and then bury it, cover it over. Where do you get the power for that? Well, you might say, well, how about solar power? And that sounds like a good idea, but if you think about it, if the sun's up and you're working, you're exposed to solar radiation. And so you're vulnerable in case one of those flares comes along. So really, you'd rather work at night. In other words, you want to land shortly before sunset. Give yourself, say, 20 hours or so, remembering the lunar day is 350 hours long, and the night is just as long. You know, 20 hours or so before sunset gives you plenty of time to start unpacking things. So, this is where the laser beam comes in. You've got photovoltaic panels. Notice I don't say solar panels. They work on the same principle, but they're tuned to the wavelength of light that's produced by that laser. And so instead of being 10 or 20% efficient, the way solar panels are, they're 60, 70, or 80% efficient. And this isn't just a theory. There's a gentleman named Jordan Kerr out in Seattle who has a company called Laser Motive who has actually demonstrated this on a large scale with multiple kilowatts of laser power. And I don't want to describe to you how frightening multiple kilowatts of laser power are, but just think about it. You know, you just burn a hole right through you without even noticing you were there.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you lay these photovoltaic panels out on the ground, and you have a little beacon, and the laser beam from the satellite homes in on them. And, of course, it's so far away that it's diffuse. It's not, it's concentrated enough to burn you or anything like that. But it homes in on these solar panels, and then you've got plenty of electrical power, tens of kilowatts, which you can use to run motors, and you can use them to recharge batteries, you can use them to run lights, you can use them to run your life support system. And remember, the way that this is set up, part of the reason for all those cargo canisters was that I planned this to have food, water, and air for two people, because you've got to work on the buddy system. You absolutely have to work on the buddy system. Food, water, and air for two people, 100% supplies for 6 months. Now, we're also going to have, for example, life support elements, which they have on the space station now. Again, this is not something that has to be invented. Life support elements, which will recycle some of that water and some of that oxygen. So that actually stretches it out beyond 6 months, easily to 12, probably far longer than that. And in the meantime, you're building things. You're increasing your capacity to support people, right? For example, you start producing oxygen. That stretches out what you can do, or in other words, it reduces your supply requirements. So then we send another rocket launch, right, with two more settlers and another can full of stuff. It increases your available living space, it increases your industrial capability, and so what you keep doing is reducing the amount of supplies it takes per man month, basically, and every time you cut that in half, increase the number of people by 50%. And what happens? Pretty soon, you're very self-sufficient. But you can imagine this initial encampment then. You know, you've got the rockets sitting there on the ground. You've got the mound where the can has been buried. You've got the travel trailer sticking up to one side. You know, you've got the little industrial pilot plants, because that's a big part of the cargo. You know, sitting around on the surface, you've got a guy in a space suit, perhaps, coming out to check on them every once in a while. Obviously, you want to use the most robotics, teleoperation, automation you can, but people say, why don't you do it all with robots? My answer is, I want to get people into space, and that's one thing that robots can't do. People will say, why don't you build it all with robots before you get there? Wouldn't that make it easier? Answer, if everything worked perfectly in a perfect world, sure, but if your robots break down, you're stuck and you can't get anywhere. Whereas if you assume you're going to do it with humans from the beginning, what happens? If you need a guy there to fix something, he's there.
Yeah, look how many of the Martian probes didn't function properly.
Exactly. From the very beginning, there was a thing called the Orbital Astronomical Observatory back in the early 60s. And I have a journal article, which the people who built it wrote about it, talking about how automated it was, and how it wouldn't require any human intervention, and how it obviously showed that you don't need man in space to do big things. Orbital Astronomical Observatory didn't work, and they tracked down the problem with it, and the fault was something that could have been solved in 5 minutes by a man with a screwdriver.
Uh-huh. Well, obviously, since there wasn't a man, it didn't get solved and it didn't work.
Exactly. And so that was basically why we didn't have the Hubble telescope decades ahead of time. And, of course, the Hubble telescope is a really good example of something that worked amazingly well that should never have. You know, they replaced and repaired and refurbished so many things on that telescope that were never supposed to be touched once it left the ground. Now imagine for a moment that it had been designed to do those things, right? Because they took apart all kinds of stuff and pulled out old parts, put in new parts that were never, those panels were never supposed to have been opened. No. But they did it anyway. Now imagine for a moment that the people who designed the Hubble had designed it from the very beginning to be completely taken apart and rebuilt. It was designed to be serviced, because in those days, they thought that space shuttle would be flying pretty frequently, and you could occasionally send a shuttle mission out to refuel it or something. But it was only minimal service. What they actually wound up doing, they wound up replacing major parts of it in orbit, which it was never designed for, and they did it very, very well. But they had to train intensively for it. They had great difficulty doing it, and a big part of that difficulty was due to weightlessness, as I mentioned before. Now, if you've seen Lunarsea, you know that I spent some time down in at his house in Houston talking with great Al Bean, Apollo astronaut Al Bean from Apollo 12. And I asked him, because he's the only person now alive who could answer this question, because Al and his shipmate Pete Conrad were the commanders of the first two Skylab missions. And Skylab was the early American space station which had a great big open space in the middle. It was built out of a used fuel tank for a rocket. And it was so big, in fact, that you could have taken the Soviet space station at the time and put it right in there, and it wouldn't have touched the walls.
Uh-huh.
So I asked Al, I said, can you give me an idea? Given the things that you did on the moon for Apollo 12 and the things that you did on Skylab, can you give me an idea of the relative difficulty? In other words, if you had those same tasks to do on the moon, that you had on Skylab, would they have been easier or harder? He said, everything that we did on Skylab would have been hugely easier on the moon. Now, everyone will talk to you about how the moon is not a great working environment, how, for example, there's dust that gets into everything and destroys things, and it's perfectly true. But that great advantage of being able to take a wrench to something and turn it and not go flying off into space pays for a lot of things.
Yeah, that is very, very true. And the ability to have a worker walk from their living quarters to the work site without worrying about them floating off into space is huge, too.
There are lots of advantages, but as I say, the number one advantage is simply that there's stuff there. In other words, there's minerals. We have hundreds of kilograms of samples from the Apollo missions. So we know pretty well what the materials are that you find at the surface to work with. And there have been decades of people finding ways to work with them. I've got books here on my desk. For example, there's a book entitled Lunar Bases and Space Activities of the 21st Century. And there was a second book under the same title, which was actually two volumes, which came out of a series of conferences hosted by the Lunar and Planetary Institute in the 80s. And these are full of information, the best guesses of people at the time, on how you would work with materials from the moon. And remember, that was before, for example, the development of 3D printing that we have today, which is a very powerful technology. So, and it's before some of the other developments which have happened in the past 20 years. The FCC Cambridge process for manufacturing titanium, for example, and some other processes like that. It was also before the large-scale introduction of cast basalt technology into the United States. So, these are not difficult or unstudied problems. And so you go to the moon, and there's stuff there. Obviously, in most of space, there isn't stuff. If there were, we'd call it sand, not space. Some people say, well, wouldn't you rather go to Mars? Answer is, well, Mars isn't really all that much more hospitable. It's inconvenient to get to. You can go to the moon any day of the month, and it takes 3 days to get there. Mars, with the rockets we have today, Mars is roughly a 9-month trip, and that's a trip you can take roughly every 2 years. And so if anything goes wrong, anything at all, you have to be able to stick it out for 3 years and more before there's any hope of help of any description. The moon is so much easier. Another point, again, we have all those samples. We know very well what's there, and we have some grasp on how to work with it. Again, the moon is close enough for a telephone conversation. I mean, Richard Nixon had a telephone conversation with Neil Armstrong on the moon. It's close enough for a telephone conversation. If you've got a problem, you can phone somebody up and say, give me a hand here, Mac. Do I turn clockwise or counterclockwise? You know, how do I do this? And that's
right.
Really important in the medical emergency. I don't know if you know this, but during the Second World War, the United States had a large fleet of submarines in the Pacific Ocean. And the submarines had small crews, and they didn't have anything like a doctor on board. The closest thing they had was a Navy guy called a pharmacist's mate, whose main job was to dispense aspirin and things and, you know, bandage up people's cuts. Now, more than once during the Second World War, one of those pharmacist mates actually performed surgery Emergency surgery, appendectomies most often. And how did they do it? The answer is just is pretty simple. They got on the radio and they called Pearl Harbor
everything.
And they got the Navy surgeon from the Naval Base Hospital, who specialized in this case, to talk him through it.
Uh-huh.
And you can do that on the moon. You couldn't do it on Mars. On Mars, you've got 15-minute round trip for radio signals, and that's at a minimum.
So, yeah, there's a big difference. And, it, you know, I can on the moon, you can even imagine video conferencing, because with our technology today, I think it would be possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Matter of fact, one of the things that I like to talk about is I'd like to see the World Science Fiction Convention be held partly on the moon, using two-way high-definition video links so that people who are on the moon can participate with people who are on Earth. And you can imagine you could do the same thing for professional conferences or for medical emergencies or anything. I mean, yeah, if you had video links so that the surgeon could see what you were doing and talk you through it, that'd be much easier than trying to do it over the phone.
Mm-hmm. Now, we are getting down. We've only got about 5 minutes left. I know you have a lot of different links that are important to people that are interested in this project. You want to kind of talk about where people can find out more information?
Yeah, okay. So the very first place that I want to suggest you go is, again, the Luna Project homepage, www.lunarcc.org. That's the word lunar and then CC. CC is for Coordinating Committee. It's not have my initials. The idea is that the Lunar Coordinating Committee is something I've been trying to put together for a long time, just the people who will be going along with me, at least on the Earthbound part of this voyage, and hopefully some of them on the spacebound part of this voyage. Another place that you can go, and now I want to, like I say, I want to encourage everybody to purchase merchandise or donate money. There are easy links there. There's also a link to this crowdfunding campaign I'm trying to do to create Luna Project medalettes. This is one of the merchandise items that I've been very successful with. They're little coins. I mentioned I was a coin collector. Little coins which have got the Luna Project logo and slogan on them. And that's something which somebody will buy them, yeah, sure, and then show them to his friends. That's the key. Again, that's the key of all my merchandising activities. Buttons, medalettes, bumper stickers. So the medalettes I had made in the beginning are running out. And as a coin collector and an inventor, we haven't touched on that much, but you can probably guess by some of the things I've described that I am an inventor. I could make those coins myself if I had the money for some machinery. And so that's one of the things I'm trying to do through this crowdfunding campaign. And so there's a link for that on the Luna Project homepage down near the bottom.
Okay.
Now, other places you can go. You can look up the Luna Project on Facebook. I do have to say there's the Luna Project. That's me. There's also Luna Project, which is either some kind of ad for sleeping pills or some other thing. You'll know it when you see it. I did have somebody actually complaining about the price of sleeping pills on the Luna Project Facebook page the other day, but I'm sure that was a mistake. I've never put anybody to sleep yet, although I'm sure there must be somebody out there who's snoozing by now. But another place you can go that's full of great space information, National Space Society, NSS.org. I am a director of the National Space Society. I would be gratified if people would join the NSS. As I've said, I don't want to create new organizations. There are plenty of organizations out there. National Space Society has a chapters network. It is dedicated to the O'Neill vision. It needs new blood to really get started on that direction because a lot of the current members have been members for a long time and they're kind of burned out. I'm just going to say that honestly from my experience of being in the organization and being on the board. Now, what else? The Moon Society. I'm also a member of the Moon Society. Actually, its president currently is in the same National Space Society chapter as I am here in North Texas. The Moon Society, let me see. I believe that that's just moonsociety.org. Let me make sure that that's true. Moon Society, yes. Moonsociety.org. Moon Society also has chapters. It's smaller, but very active. So those are very good places to go. Like I say, the National Space Society website is a great source for information. And that's one of the reasons I actually have it linked from the Luna Project homepage, because they've got a space library. If you go up to the tab that says Exploration Development, come down, Space Library, that's got lots and lots of great material on the...
Well, it looks like we have lost Christopher. But yeah, check out those links, folks. We are running out of time here, so I will tell you all good night. I hope that tonight's program has brought everyone a little bit more illumination for your own personal journey towards truth, as well as a little bit of entertainment. With that, I bid you all good night. Tune in again next week for another episode of The Dawn of Shades with a whole new topic and a whole new voice to tell you all about it. And good night.